The following talk was given at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on October 8, 2023. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Hey, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Nice to see you all here. For those of you who don't know, I'm Steve Matuszek, the head teacher here at Dharma Field. And I'm going to introduce our guest speaker. Most of you probably know who I am, and you probably know who Dokai is, so I'm just going to kind of keep it short. But Dokai is like Shokin. We get Shokin and Dokai to visit us every fall, and it's always a pleasure for them to come speak. Dokai is he's a Dharma heir of Katagiri Roshi, and so he's a Dharma brother of Steve's and Norm's. And I know it's always a pleasure to hear Dokai give talks. He's are you still the guiding teacher at Hokkyoji, Dokai? Yeah, guiding teacher at Hokkyoji Zen Practice Community in southeastern Minnesota. It's really a lovely practice space, so a place that I'm hoping Dharma Field can get to once we get our numbers back up again. So Dokai, I'm just going to go ahead and turn this over to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. And good morning to all of you. First off, while I see there's a fair number of online participants here, I believe it might be one of your strategies or hopes to get people back in the Zendo again. And that's what I think I have heard. And I can really appreciate that. As you all know, when the pandemic hit, I think Zoom saved a lot of our lives at least Zen centers and things like that. So, and hopefully the, you know, pandemic is going downward. I don't think Zooming is really a substitute for getting together in person and practicing together. I'm just speaking from personal experience. I've noticed that Hokkyoji uses a lot of Zooming because we're way out in the middle of nowhere. And so we have daily Zazen with Zooming, even though we have two or three people who live here. But we also have Sunday Dharma talks. In fact, there's one going on right now that we do by Zoom. And even with our residents here, we don't actually get together for those Sunday Dharma talks. We usually do it from our own rooms. So it's a little strange because we would have the situation where I would get up in front of like two people and give a Dharma talk. And that's kind of a little bit of a strange feeling. In any event, I'm just here to encourage you as much as possible to see if you can get back to the Zendo as much as possible. We here at Hokkyoji, we had a summer session of which I led with two other people, Daigaku Rume, and also Reiren Gumbo. And they refused to use Zoom. It's like, no Zoom for us for this session. I'm a little more on the edge. Yeah, but we have like three people, you know, one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast, that kind of thing. But they said no Zoom. So, so that's that. I'm not going to belabor the point. Oh, yeah, and then Steve asked me, am I still the Hokkyoji's guiding teacher? Well, we're starting to look at a way in which I might not be that guiding teacher for a lot longer. I'm 72 years old. I was very enamored with Shoaku Okamura, who said, like, when he was 65 years old or something like that, says, well, I'm going to work until I'm 75 at Sanchen, where he's the abbot. And then I'm going to concentrate after 75 on getting old and dying. That's going to be my practice. So I was like pretty impressed with that. And particularly when he said it in his late 60s or something like that. And he followed through. He followed through. He turned 75 this year, and he turned over the Zen Center to a former resident of Hokyoji, Hoko Jan Carnegas. So he followed through with that. So I did the same thing. I said it out there with the board of directors that at 75, I'm going to retire from my major responsibilities here at Hokyoji. That's 3 years from now. So that presents a whole realm of thoughts, but I'm not going to go into them right now. But what I am going to talk about is a book from Karigiri Roshi's lectures edited by Steve Hagen called You Have to Say Something. And the chapter of the book is Using the Selfish Self. Zazen is good practice for us. We can call it perfume, because it scents our life. Of course, whatever we practice scents our life. If, for example, you become an army officer, your life becomes very army-like. Even when you wear normal clothes, people can still smell your army clothes. Because I am a Zen priest from Japan, even when I wear Western clothes, people can still smell the monk on me. I cannot escape. So I like this metaphor. In this case, it's a metaphor of Zazen is a perfume, because it scents our life. I think a perfume works best when it's applied with subtlety. My younger brother once became aware of cologne. He was 4 years younger than me. He had a cognitive disability, rather severe, but he became acquainted with cologne and the smell that it had. So he dumped a whole bottle on him, you know, and so you got within 20 feet of him and you could start smelling this cologne. And like I say, he was cognitively, you know, not like probably everyone else here. So it was one of the only admonitions I ever made to my brother. And I said, Steve, you know, I think it'd be better if you just put a little bit of cologne, not the whole bottle, on you for your purpose. And oddly enough, he looked at me and with just really kind of intense eyes, and he says, "Okay, Ron." It's like he never listened to me, but under that statement, he listened. So that's a kind of a, maybe when I read this sentence, it has another kind of meaning for me. So he says, of course, whatever we practice scents our lives, if you're an army officer. I think most of us, if we started doing Buddhist practice when we were very young, particularly someone like me in the early 70s, there was some kind of a consciousness that, you know, army people were not like the best people around in the world. And at least that was my idea, misguided as it was. In any event, after a number of years here at Hokyoji, a practitioner, a serious practitioner showed up, and she had been in the army, and her husband was a high-ranking military officer in the U.S. Army. And so I needed to adjust my whole perception of people in our Sangha coming from different places in their lives. So at one point where he says here, because I'm a Zen priest, people can still smell the monk on me. At one point about, well, I think now it's been about 6 years ago, I had the desire. I lived here at Hokkyoji for about 15 years. I mean, and this was the only place where I lived. But I had the desire to maybe have some kind of life that was not a Zen monk kind of life, at least not the primary presentation. So I got an apartment in La Crosse, which is about 30 miles away. And I started spending about 3 days a week there and 4 days here. And I started, I didn't use my Buddhist name, Dokai, when I was signing up for like exercise classes, Zumba classes at the Y and yoga classes. I used the name my mom and dad gave me, Ron. And thinking, I don't want to be seen as a Zen teacher, just an ordinary person with no special status. And so I did that, and now it's been about 4 or 5 years since then. And now because I live in a small, La Crosse is not a big town, like 50,000, 51,000. And of course, where I live is even less, way less. And there's been some crossover, like the people in yoga, some of the people, not very many, but a small, very small handful, know me as Dokai from Hokkyoji. And so now I've had to make the decision to what name am I going to use? So I had to change back to, I changed back to Dokai. But anyway, it kind of gave me the example. There's no escaping. Now, the only other escape could be if I did like Dharma field people do and just called myself Ron all the time, like Steve does and Norm does and everyone and all the rest of the people. In any event, that's just a little anecdote about not being able to escape the clothing that we wear. So about this perfume, he says, we often don't like the smells that perfume the air around us, so we resist them. We say we want to be free, but the kind of freedom that includes such resistance is questionable. True freedom is not found in the air that surrounds you. You find it by noticing how you resist the perfume of others. And then moment to moment, you let yourself breathe whatever perfume fills the air. So this is a challenging practice, probably the most challenging practice. I don't think our Zen practice is particularly, in some ways, it's not particularly hard to understand. In some ways it is, but in other ways it isn't. So we notice how we resist the perfume of others. Now this is really, I think, the ultimate Zen practice, because it's really others, or I'll even say other people, usually, that create the most difficulty for us, the perfume of their existence. At least that's, I'm just speaking from personal experience. I used to work as a nurse, and I would say, you know, if you put a grading scale, I would say like I was a grading scale of a C minus nurse. It was hard work, but I had the opportunity to work with a lot of other people who I thought were A plus nurses. They just were so sensitive to the patient's needs that it was totally amazing to me. And I probably don't have to go into a lot of graphic detail, but there was a lot of smells and tastes, and not tastes, but smells and sights that were not very pleasant to experience when you're a nurse. I was just struck by how a lot of my companions were just not moved by these kind of very unpleasant things that had to be dealt with when they were dealing with the patients. Now, a little later, you know, in the break room, you know, maybe we would make a joke about something that was really hard, but in the presence of the patient, there was no altercation of in the what you're presented with. At least with those folks, me, I struggled a bit. It did remind me of a passage I read about the life of Mother Teresa, where she said some younger one of her disciples or nuns, however it works, was picking off some maggots of a wound of one of, you know, basically a homeless person in Calcutta. I don't think it's called Calcutta anymore. I don't know what it's called, but in any event, she was kind of wincing and, you know, that kind of icky kind of thing. And she says, "Don't do that. You know, this is the body of Christ." And when I read that, I was really deeply moved by that. It's like, you know, Christ isn't somebody, you know, way up in the air, at least in her opinion. It's just this homeless person lying on the bed with maggots in the wound and pulling them out as needed. So I think this is really the practice of Zen Buddhism. Like I say, it's not so profound, really. It's just, how do we deal with the very challenging circumstances that present us every day? Sometimes within our own sanghas as well. Maybe that's most of it. Some of it, of course, comes from our families. And some of it comes from looking at the world and our situation. Kadagiri goes on to say, we sometimes have the idea that if we don't think of ourselves first, we will fall behind. But the more we try to get ahead, the more exhausted we become. We cannot escape self-centered ideas. I've given up the idea of trying to get ahead these days. I'm just trying to keep even. And that in itself seems to be a challenge. just doing the dishes, cooking food, taxes, car repairs, computer issues, trying to just keep moving evenly. So yeah, the self-centered idea here is not that I want to get ahead, but I don't want to fall behind, so far behind. So instead of denying or destroying the self, we must ask, how can we use our selfish self in simple, practical way? To use the selfish self compassionately is the practice of Zen Buddhism. Compassion is like spring water coming up from the ground, and it can be used to sustain everyone. Sometimes we might waver, believing if that's true or not, depending on our personal situation. Compassion is like spring water coming up from the ground, and it can be used to sustain everyone. There's other places where Katagiri uses this simile. Compassion is like spring water coming up from the ground endlessly. We have a spring here at Hokyoji. It's been here since I got here in 1980. And just seems to continuously come up from the ground. He really appreciated that metaphor or simile. But even if we learn to use our life for all sentient beings, we may still have a sense of selfishness. I'm using my selfishness for everyone. That's an idea. I am saving all sentient beings. Well, he says, it's better to just help others without leaving any trace. There's no reason to think I am doing this for others. Well, that's true. I mean, that's a good recipe for burnout if we are carrying that conception around with us that I'm really doing this for the benefit of all beings, when we're actually suffering ourselves. In original Buddhism, Nikayas, the Buddha says a statement that's quite moving for me. He says, the conceit I am is abandoned, and all I-making activity ceases. And just those simple words are just so striking to me. Just the Buddha saw or experienced that just this idea that I am is conceitful. Now, we usually don't see it that way, but he's seeing things on a different scope. Just to assert that I am is conceit. I'm not going to evaluate that as good or bad, but it's just, that's what it is. And then he talks about abandoning all, ceasing all I-making activity. Now, this is where I think Zazen really is good practice for us. And it's like a perfume. It's doing something, but we're not quite aware of it, especially if we wear it subtly. Because when we do Zazen, we can see the vastness of the eye-making activity. And we see it even more clearly when we actually, when our mind actually settles down more, our mind and body. When they settle down, we see the vast vast. A word I like from original Buddhism too is craving, the vast craving that we have. Speak a little bit about that a little later. I think I will. So in other words, you have to extend your idea of self to include everyone and everything. Now this is our practice is can be very challenging. For instance, consider a baby and its mother. The baby offers no words. She doesn't say, I'm hungry, sleepy, I have a stomach ache. She doesn't say anything. She just cries. Yet behind her crying, the mother understands what she wants. At that time, she can establish the self that is exactly the same as that of others, as her baby. What is the true self of the mother? Of the baby, they are exactly the same. So that's a metaphor again Katagiri is using, but it's not different from me or anyone else. We have to understand the cries that people are making, even if there's no words. I'm going to go on and talk a few sentences from the next chapter called Egolessness. Impermanence, the fact that everything is constantly changing, is one of Buddha's main teachings. It is not so easy to stand up in this world of constant change. Nothing lasts, not our bodies, not our minds, not our likes or our dislikes. If this is true, how should we live? Well, the last chapter was called Using the Selfish Self, and this one's called Egolessness. So if this is true, how should we live? And then he says, in egolessness. Egolessness is not about destroying or ignoring the subjective side of life. It means noticing that subjectivity is intimately related to what appears out there. In other words, both the subject me and the object that exist together beyond our likes and dislikes. The important point then is how to exist within this realm that comprises both self and object, or subject and object. In other words, how can we live in peace and harmony? And this is why, again, why Zazen is so important for us to do, I believe, because we can see the vastness of the craving that emerges. And I particularly do appreciate this word craving. And the Buddha speaks about three kinds of craving. One is the craving for sensual pleasures. And one is the craving for existence, and one is craving for non-existence. And these are very important, I'll say, models or maps or conceptual maps for me. The craving for sensual pleasures, okay, that one I'm not going to get into. I think we all have a pretty firm understanding of that. However, the craving for existence, now this one is, I think, getting into a more subtle place. And again, I'd like to go back to Zazen. and ask you to consider what's going on when you're doing zazen. Are there thoughts about eye-making activity? I would suspect there are, if you're anything like me. Lots of eye-making activity. And this eye-making activity, if we examine it closely, they're about stories. They're about the stories we create during zazen. And if we examine those stories, I think inevitably we will find the subject of that story is myself. Just examine that sometime when you're doing zazen. See if there's any story you create that where you're not the center of attention. I haven't found that yet in any kind of story I create. Even if it's about, you know, my brother or my sister or parents or something. It's usually about me and my relationship to them. So this is when I say about this eye-making activity, it's like the craving for existence, the craving that I am something. It's very interesting. And I can't think of any other word except just craving. There's just a craving for it. And even when we become quiet in zazen, to a degree where that usually doesn't occur, it won't be long before we will start to create something like, wow, this is really nice. I like this. This is the way it's supposed to be. But still, that's just the beginning of more craving. That's how subtle it is. After that, when we get really, really tired of everything that happens in zazen, like it's just the same old thing going on and on and on, over and over and over again. And this might happen more often, like doing a long retreat, like 7 days or so. Then we might generate a longing or craving for non-existence. Meaning, I just want this to end. It's just too much suffering. Just constantly creating the same ideas about the world over and over again. We can experience this in zazen too, where we just get tired of it. And then we crave for non-existence. But it's the same kind of craving from a different angle. Different perspective. So the point is, how do we sit there and just not, we stop the cycle of craving. The world is completely beyond our likes and dislikes. All things work together as a dynamic whole. Because of impermanence, of thoroughgoing change, there is nothing to hold on to. In Buddhism, we say everything is empty. All emptiness is just constant change. Now that's what I think that's about the best definition of emptiness that I've heard. It's just, all it is constant change. Because there's nothing that's singularly existing as its own entity for even a moment. Yep. And that's just how it is. But don't think you can understand emptiness with concepts. There's no way to grasp it. So that is to say, even if we say emptiness is constant change, we're still relegating it to the conceptual world. So we just have to experience that. And have to stand up in that place. The depth of human life is ungraspable. Well, I've talked for 35 minutes. I think I've done my job. Although I didn't get a job description. But in any event, I'd like to open it up for comments. I sometimes said, I've said this a number of times. I don't know if I've said it here, but I grew up in the Methodist tradition. And we had a sermon, you know, every Sunday. The length of that sermon was no longer than 15 minutes. I don't know if any of you had that experience. But then when I got into Buddhism, Buddhism is like you talk for an hour. I say, what in the world can you say for an hour that you can't say in 15 minutes? I never understood it. Well, after you listen to Katagiri Roshi for years and years and years, you'll kind of get a sense of that, why it goes on for an hour. And anyway, I'm not inclined to speak for an hour, so I would invite any comments or questions. And I might have trouble seeing your hands or something, so someone might have to guide me through that. Someone kind of monitor. I don't know quite how you do it. You can also rebut. I'm always open to rebuttals.
Do okay?
Yeah.
I like your simple, no-nonsense approach. I have a question about meditation. Or whenever I'm relaxed, really relaxed, I hear a kind of a ringing in my ear. It's not tinnitus, but I think it's called nada in some traditions. And when I immerse myself in that sound, a lot of the cares and concerns of daily life just vanish. I'm wondering, does this have anything, is there any role for this in Zen thought or tradition?
Well, I haven't had that experience. I've had a little bit of tinnitus in my life, but it resolves, you know, in a few seconds, probably something like seconds. I'm not sure I would appreciate having that experience during Zazen, but maybe you're lucky. I don't know. But it seems as if it's a particular sensation that you're focusing on. And yeah, I think that's, you know, that's sort of what happens in Zazen. We get focused on something. And we don't have to explain it. We know that this is we're touching reality more closely than everything that we're fabricating in our minds. The Buddha has a very interesting sutta. I think it's the shortest sutta I've ever read. It's one sentence. Says, how do we know something is fabricated? And he says, it has a beginning, it has an end, and it has alteration through its course of existence. And it's fabricated. And then he says, so that's the whole sutra. And then there's another one that says, what's the unfabricated? And he says, the beginning and the end and the alteration of the state is not known. In other words, there's not a beginning, not an end, or not variation. And that's what we call unfabricated. So I think it's the unfabricated that we're trying to understand. Because the fabricated is pretty easy. We understand that pretty well. We're fabricating things all the time. But the unfabricated is a little more challenging to grasp or to see or to experience. But to me, that sounds like what you're talking about, just through the practice of concentrating on one thing directly, we see how we create so many things in our mind that are not really in connection with reality. I don't know if that helps or not.
Well, in my case, it doesn't involve will at all. I just, I acquiesce silently, and I don't try to make anything out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I find it very reassuring. It has no content. It's just a sound.
Mm-hmm.
But not, I'm not sure it's a really a sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I
mean, it's not like tinnitus.
Yeah.
But I find it very reassuring, and I just sort of surrender to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, things like sight and sound are still fabrications of our mind. I mean, things we call those things. I mean, really, it's like, okay, let's get down to the bottom of it. There's really not much going on. It's pretty empty out there. But it's actually where the fullness of a life resides, I believe. Because if we have our mind full of ideas, we can't really meet anything, a person or a thing or an idea, I think, with openness. Okay, how do we work through this? So our minds have to be pretty clear of all of its fabrications and my own ideas.
I like that.
Thank you. Thank you for your question, Peter.
Okay, we have a question here at Dharma Field.
Okay, I'm not seeing where it's coming from. Is it coming from your room there?
Yeah, can you see the room?
I see the room.
Yeah, I see the waving hand.
barely. I don't have very good eyesight. But,
yeah, okay.
We okay. were just, good morning, Dokai. I'm Christine. We were just discussing this, I believe, Thursday morning in our discussion group here, reading Returning to Silence, one of the chapters, and the delineations of clinging came up, and you brought that up again today. And I guess in my mind, I'm wondering if that clinging or craving for existence and then non-existence, if when you pose those examples together, if they're considered to be opposites of one another or just examples of how we experience clinging.
I would say not opposites. I would say different aspects of the same thing. Even though we don't think they are, that's how I perceive them. The craving for existence. We can experience it about two different ways. One is like during Zazen, when life, you know, is basically just going along. the way it normally does, and we set aside our hour or whatever to meditate. Another aspect of realizing that is when we have a severe loss or severe trauma, we notice just that, you know, that constant craving to understand something. Why, you know, why, whatever. So that's kind of a, you know, a kind of a craving too. It's different. And then, well, the craving for non-existence, of course, we all know people who have suffered so deeply that they believe that ending their life will be, a way to end their suffering. So that's, but it's not unrelated, I don't think, to me either. Just, I want this to stop, you know, something like that. Still happens now, kind of like, you know, just, I speak of retirement, and it's like, I kind of don't want to do all this stuff anymore. That's kind of hard to do. I'd kind of like to just sit back and relax for my last, whatever, many of years I have left. But it's, so it's still kind of a craving. And so, no, I don't think the craving for non-existence is kind of opposite. I think it's the same thing from a different perspective. That's how I would put it. I don't know if that answers or addresses your question or not. Was it Christy? Is that who you?
Christine.
Christine. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. I think I'll pass it back to Steve.
All right. Thank you so much, Tokai. Pleasure as always.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.